Peterson, and thank you for coming, and thanks for Tim for inviting me to give a lecture. I'm going to talk for just a relatively short period of time and sort of summarize some things about satellite cells. I know you've heard a smattering of this through different lectures from John and from Esther and an introduction sort of more formally in terms of regeneration from Kevin on Monday. And you all received a review paper, which we think really summarizes nicely sort of the state of knowledge, really, and the lack thereof of really what satellite cells or the muscle stem cells are doing in muscle. So I thought I would just go over, sort of tie it together, show you some of the primary data that review article is based upon, and then what mostly I want to focus on then, I probably will talk in perhaps half an hour, that then at the end of that review and at the end of my slides, there's some what we think are perhaps the most outstanding questions in the field, and we thought we could get some discussion going on if you were to design an experiment to try to answer some of these questions or further the field, what would you do, and always keeping in mind too the issue of we can do so much in rodent models, particularly mice, because of the genetic ability to manipulate genetics in terms of translatability. How much of this is relevant to humans is one of the things that we can talk about and see how we might address that in humans. And so as Kevin, I think, introduced, you know, real formally, and I think John and everybody, the issue, and of course the reason this has been highlighted is that what a lot of us work on, and perhaps the graduate students from my lab have a little bit of an advantage here because we talk about satellite cells all the time, and hopefully they'll help in really leading the discussion. But so these were discovered about 60 years ago, really described, you know, because normally when you see the structure of muscle, this little satellite cell sitting beneath the basement membrane is not included in most textbooks if you look at structures of muscle. And they've been studied a lot because of the advent of the development of an antibody against this transcription factor called PAX7, which in muscle is absolutely satellite cell specific. And so here on a single muscle fiber, you can see them, so they're really easy to see. I just wanted to show you, this is just an image from our lab on cross sections of muscle, mouse muscle, where you can see that this antibody, using fluorescence immunohistochemistry, you can count and you can quantify and you can really clearly study these cells. You can see they're pretty rare, right? So that stem cells are usually pretty rare, but they're relatively easy to follow and under certain circumstances to be able to study them. And as Kevin introduced last week, what we know about them, and it's really clear now, is that they really are stem cells and they're responsible for the really amazing regenerative capacity of your skeletal muscle. Unlike cardiac muscle, where if you have a heart attack, you damage your heart, you're pretty much done, because although there may be a rare population of stem cells in cardiac muscle, how to immobilize them and their ability to repair the cardiac muscle is really, really limited. Satellite cells, on the other hand, are these that they become activated, they proliferate, they can migrate from an uninjured fiber to an injured fiber, they move in and they can fuse together to form small little myotubes, which then eventually repair the fiber. And this can happen in repairing regions, because, you know, with muscle fibers being these long syncytia, you can have regional damaged areas and the satellite cells move in and repair them. In addition, in certain models, which I think probably you were introduced to, like cardiotoxin injection and various things where you cause the entire muscle to turn to mush like this, the satellite cells can actually move in underneath the basement membrane, line up, fuse together, and reform a fiber de novo. And so they're really amazing cells. And that just to point out that you can identify a regenerated muscle fiber by the fact that the nuclei are in the center. And what happens is when the satellite cells fuse together, the nucleus is in the center. But eventually, probably because of the formation of the sarcomere, you know, you get the contractile apparatus, so all the organelles are sort of pushed to the periphery. So the nuclei in a normal muscle fiber are really on the edge, because you want the actin and the myosin contractile apparatus to be as uninterrupted as possible. And so this we know, and it was pretty much definitively demonstrated through the use of this mouse by four different labs, including ours. And I think John introduced this to you, so I'm just not going to go into any detail. But it's been an amazing tool, because up until about 5 or 6 years ago, it was all circumstantial, but it was pretty clear satellite cells were involved in regeneration. But it was through the ability to actually kill them, so to wipe them out in muscle, that it became clear that really satellite cells were the muscle stem cell, and that there isn't any other population they can substitute. Because if you take an adult mouse, and as John explained, you know, you can cross two mouse lines together. The nice thing is this is inducible, so the recombinase isn't active unless you give the mouse tamoxifen. This activates the pre-recombinase, removes this stop codon, so this strong promoter drives this diphtheria toxin gene, and it will kill the cell. I think I have one. My daughter's into animation. So, so this has been a really powerful model, because at any time in the life of the mouse, you can kill satellite cells and see what happens and then do different things. And, of course, most of the field is interested in this regeneration ability for obvious reasons. And what you can see is that, absolutely, here's after a week, barium chloride causes massive muscle degeneration. And you can see the little centrally nucleated fibers that have regenerated after a week. In the tamoxifen-treated animals, regeneration is really seriously impaired. Okay? But what I want to focus on, so this has been known now, and everybody's very well accepted in the field, and people are studying this because under certain circumstances and in degenerative diseases like muscular dystrophy, how can we facilitate the ability of the satellite cells to repair muscle? In aging, the muscle satellite cells decline, and so the idea is if you injure your muscles all throughout your life, and as you get older, your satellite cells decline, you can see that if you're not able to repair your muscles, then you would lose muscle and you would become weaker and all that sort of thing. So they're heavily studied within the context of regeneration. However, what's been way less studied but sort of assumed is that satellite cells are involved in all kinds of other muscle things, response to stimuli, and even in muscle maintenance over the lifespan. And that's what I just wanted to focus on, because in recent years sort of that's been starting to be focused on, and it was summarized nicely by Kevin's review. And as I said, I'm just going to highlight the high points. I'm hoping you all read that so that we're not going to go into great detail, because mostly then I want to get a discussion going on it. And so what I'm going to start with is, so there are a number of different, when you think about external stimuli, of course, more physiological, and that is exercise. You know, there's aerobic endurance exercise, there's resistance exercise, there's being immobilized, so a sedentary lifestyle or bed rest or something. You know, what do satellite cells do? Do they do anything? And of course, it's assumed, as I said, for years, everybody, the start of every grant that I review starts out and says, you know, satellite cells are important for muscle maintenance, and they're important for response, and they're important for adaptability, but they're really pretty limited data, you know, hard data showing that. So, the first thing I want to talk about is immobilization. And so, this is work primarily from Esther's lab, and what it shows is that, you know, as you expect, you know, a model of hind limb suspension where you can hang a rat or a mouse by its tail, so its hind limbs are just barely off the floor, just as Esther, I know, talked about atrophy last week. So this is the model, so you hind limb suspend them, and you can see that when you then let them reambulate, this is after just 10 days perhaps, you know, they start, muscle mass is restored, and eventually it'll go back to normal in an adult mouse, and it doesn't make any difference if the satellite cells are there in the vehicle treated or not there in the tamoxifen treated, which was a big surprise, and one of the first models we tested, because we had assumed they must be needed for this, because there were data there, mostly in rats, showing that when you do atrophy muscle, you lose nuclei. So you need to replace them when you regrow. That would be satellite cells fusing in and replacing lost myonuclei. And that's been shown in rats, and it's heading that way in terms of bed rest studies in humans, but it's not entirely clear. But in the mouse, it looks like with atrophy, they don't lose myonuclei. So you don't need satellite cells. And so that was a big surprise to us. This talks about the translatability of mouse works, mice being so adaptable. They can do things that other rodents and certainly humans may not be able to do. And so that was our first, foray into, satellite cells don't look like they're involved in regrowth, at least in mouse muscle, using the PAX-7BTA model. The next model that I want to talk about in terms of exercise is endurance training. And, of course, that's one of the easiest kind of adaptations to do in mice because mice like to run. So you can just give them access to a running wheel and they'll run all night long. And so one can really look at adaptations in response to some pretty serious endurance training. And what we found is whether or not the satellite cells were there, that is, whether they were vehicle-treated or tamoxifen-treated, the main adaptation you see to endurance training, just like if you're a marathon runner and you're any kind of an endurance-trained athlete, you see this shift in fiber type. And I know you all have talked about fiber type in the mouse plantaris, which is what this muscle is. It's primarily a fast-twitch muscle. So it's got three fiber types, 2A, 2X, and 2B, 2A being the most oxidative. This muscle has very few type 1 fibers. They're really oxidative fibers. So you can see that with running, you see an increase in 2A, the green fibers, because of this switch in fiber type to a more oxidative capacity, and that the 2B fibers, which are the most glycolytic, the least oxidative, are decreased in abundance. And that shift happens whether you have satellite cells there or not. So this adaptation to running is not affected by satellite cells. And here you can see, you do start to see mostly there's a shift from the 2X and 2B fibers, more glycolytic, fast-twitch fibers, to 2A. In this muscle, you do start to see, here's, you know, your one lone pink type 1 fiber. In the mouse, it doesn't. Perhaps if we train them harder or longer, you could actually get the shift to go all the way to type 1 fibers. But certainly, this shift that you do see to a higher percentage of 2A oxidative fibers occurs independent of satellite cells. So this had been alluded to in the past in work, and so we weren't terribly surprised about this, but one adaptation or one phenotype that we noted that was a big surprise and something that we can talk about and work that was done in collaboration with Robin is that what we noted in the mice is that the ones that had been treated with tamoxifen and run, I should say the running was for 8 weeks. So these mice were just given free access to a running wheel. And we can count the revolutions on the running wheel. And so what you can see that whereas the vehicle-treated mice ran about 15 kilometers a night, which you can see, that's a long way. These mice just run all night long. The tamoxifen-treated mice only ran about 10 or less. So they still ran a lot, but it's much less, significantly less. And we found this really surprising, and the main contributor to this less distance run, although there was, it seemed to be, they spent slightly less time on the wheel, was really that they ran slower. So they just run slower. And we did a bunch of testing to see, that the satellite cells maybe are somehow involved actually in endurance, and that we tried to do some run to exhaustion and show that the muscles were more fatigued, that the mice were actually, it was a fatigue thing, that for some reason, and we spent a lot of time looking at that, but it didn't seem really pan out. And then it was somebody, and this is something that you all should always do as you're doing research and pay attention, and if you start noticing something, write it down and mention it and you know, always be observant, because a member of the lab said, well, they think that the mice were less coordinated. They just seem to stumble around and that they don't seem to be able to find the grade on the wheel and stuff. So we did some behavioral testing on the mice, and what you see, two different behavioral tests, the rotorod, which is this big wheel that just turns really slow, sort of like the log thing that the lumberjacks do, or, you know, people where you try to stay on a log a long time, that the mice are turning this and the wheel turns and they hang on, but eventually they fall off. And so the question is, how long does it take them to fall off? And what you can see is that the tamoxifen-treated animals fall off. They stay on the long, but on the rotor rod, a shorter period of time, so that the rotor rod travels less distance. And the most telling thing to me was this balance beam test, where taking a balance beam, and the mice, you know, can go across it really quickly, across a little balance beam. But as you make the balance beam narrower and narrower, you can can see that it takes the animals with no satellite cells a longer time to get across the balance beam. And it's because they slip off. And some work that we're doing now, that Davis is doing, he's even quantified foot slips per minute. And they just can't find their way. They're less coordinated. And so what it appears is that perhaps there is a selective role of satellite cells in different kinds of fibers. And what we followed up on was a kind of fiber, and tell me if anybody has talked about spindle fibers or intrafusal fibers. No? Okay, they're a specialized, so you can see, you know, cross sections, you see lots of these just regular, you know, contractile muscle fibers. There are a specialized kind of muscle fiber, very rare, but scattered throughout your muscle, that are called intrafusal fibers that are highly specialized. They're also called spindle fibers. It's the same thing, intrafusal and spindle fibers. So these are all intrafusal fibers, and you can see they sort of look like four-leaf clovers. They express myosin heavy chain, but they're especially innervated, and they're actually the proprioceptors in muscle. So they're the ones that help the animal to figure out where they are in space. So there's spatial orientation. And what you can see is that what had been reported, and why this sort of made sense and why we followed up on this, is that it had been reported, one report in the literature, that these intrafusal fibers have a particularly high concentration of satellite cells. And here, using the PAX7 antibody, but in pink, you can see one here, and sort of the nice sort of structure of a spindle fiber. They're really beautiful. If you look, when you spot them in a muscle, they just stand out like crazy. They're surrounded by laminin, which is fluorescent green. And so in the tamoxifen-treated animals, these are all gone. And you can see that the structure of these spindle fibers is very disorganized. And a theme that will be coming up on and on over and over again now as we go on is that also there's a lot of extracellular matrix. Wheat germ agglutinin binds to glycosaminoglycans in the extracellular matrix, so it's sort of a marker of the matrix surrounding all the muscle fibers. And what you can see, normally you have a lot of extracellular matrix. The laminin is part of the extracellular matrix. But you see all this accumulation, and it's really evident here. And as a result, these spindle fibers have more extracellular matrix surrounding them in the absence of satellite cells. And the little intrafusal, the size of the fibers, the diameter is smaller. And so the idea, and Robin did some recording, you know, he usually does his crawfish and invertebrate models of trying to record from these spindle fibers, but he did some recording for us, isolated these from these mouse muscles, and showed that their electrical activity is defective. And that's something that we would like to follow up on. It's just a hard thing to study in mammals. And so, but so this is a new role. I mean, it sort of implies that perhaps these fibers turn over more rapidly or repaired or just are more dependent on satellite cells than your normal old contractile muscle fiber. And it was our first sort of inkling that perhaps satellite cells have something to do with the environment surrounding the muscle fibers. And this is particularly relevant to the intrafusal and the spindle fibers. And so this was a one of those things that, again, we would never have predicted and never followed up on, but it's sort of a unique function for satellite cells in muscle adaptation. So then the one that I want to, the adaptation and the kind of exercise I want to finish on is something that you've heard quite a bit about from John, hypertrophy, and the model that we use. And it's not exactly, this is the really drastic, you know, taking out the gastroc and the soleus, leaving the plantaris that has the hypertrophy. We now have variations on a theme that Kevin primarily has developed, where you can take out, you know, just the tendon or just a portion of the gastroc. So the overload is not as intense in plantaris, so you're really trying to minimize the amount of regeneration, the amount of damage, and maximizing just the growth of fibers. But this synergist ablation model, you remove the synergist muscle, so the remaining muscle grows like crazy. Okay, so this is synergist ablation 1 week, 2 week, 4 weeks. And so this happens, and it's a nice surgical model of overloading the plantaris. So again, our work is largely focused on the plantaris, which is, as I said, primarily a fast muscle. And so that's a limitation medication, and we're working on now, and we're moved to a sort of a more physiological, non-surgical model that will get will result in muscle hypertrophy in a wider variety of muscles, so that we can study this in more detail. But basically, and again, this is just a really brief review, that in the absence of satellite cells, you really, one of the hallmarks is that, and it sort of proved that, again, just like with regeneration, when you do grow your muscles, the satellite cells provide nuclei to support this greater volume of cytoplasm. And on a muscle section here now, this red stain is dystrophin, which is in the sarcolemma. So a nucleus, and again, it's too bad, I mean, it makes it a bit more complicated that the nuclei are really pushed to the periphery, because it's sometimes hard to tell if a nucleus is inside a muscle fiber or outside a muscle fiber. But you can, on high magnification, count those that are inside, and you can count those that are outside. Those are the bona fide myonuclei that are supporting the transcriptional capacity of the muscle fiber, and that you can see that the number of these myonuclei increase with hypertrophy, just as you would expect, and then try to keep, because you get big, and you know, at some point you need another nucleus to provide more RNA for translation of sarcomeric proteins, and so that is blocked with tamoxifen. Again, just as in regeneration, showing that no other stem cell population, because there's a lot of interest, and there may be other stem cell populations in muscle, but in terms of regeneration and in terms of hypertrophy, none seems to be able to substitute for satellite cells here. But the fibers still grow. I'm sure John has talked to you about this. And this is because of this reserve capacity. Did John talk about this at all? About why, you know, one hypothesis, and maybe we can discuss this. Why, how is it that normally a nuclei fuse in? Because, you know, this idea that a single nucleus in this big syncytium can only support a certain volume of cytoplasm, and that makes sense. That up to a point, you know, it's too big and you need another nucleus, and luckily you have satellite cells and they provide that. But a former graduate student, Tyler, in the lab, did this experiment where he labeled the muscle with a uridine analog called EU, which gets just incorporated into newly synthesized RNA. Okay? And then you can use a what's called click chemistry, sort of like immunohistochemistry, to see it in the sections. And what he did, the experiment that's shown here is that he did this intradiscal ablation, and then he waited 3 days, and then injected EU 5 hours before he killed some mice. Now the SA means days, 3 days. Some he let go more, 5 hours before he killed them. He injected EU, let it go 5 hours, killed them, and then let some go another additional week, injected with EU, and kill them. And the idea is that with that short pulse of EU, mostly, you know, most of what you're transcribing in any nucleus is ribosomal RNA, right? And so that's the vast majority of the RNA being produced. And with the short pulse, you could see that RNA accumulating in the nucleus before it gets shunted out into the cytoplasm to make a ribosome. And so what he found, and this was kind of surprising, is that, and so now here, as opposed to PAX7 staining, what the pink nuclei are EU-positive nuclei. So they are highly transcriptionally active nuclei. And what was surprising to us is just in resting muscle, there isn't much EU lately with this time pulse. So that the nuclei, whereas, you know, I was just expecting there to be sort of a lot more lately, there aren't that many pink nuclei. You look at 3 days after synergist ablation, I hope you can see. Well, I don't know, do we need to turn out the light, or can you see the pink nuclei? I hope you can see that, you know, almost in every single myonucleus, 70-80% of the myonuclei are strongly pink. One interesting thing, almost none of the interstitial nuclei are, which was sort of a surprise because, you know, macrophages infiltrate, there's all kinds of stuff going on, but they're not that transcriptionally active compared to a myonucleus. But what was even more surprising is that by a week, it's back down, and by 2 weeks, it's back down to almost baseline sham levels, even though the muscle's still growing, right? It's growing a lot here. It's still growing here. As if you crank out transcription, and here the regulation is probably more at the level of translation. So you've got this large amount of RNA, and now that we're really ramping up is translating it into protein on these ribosomes that you form. So this was sort of surprising that that this was the case. But now let's look at that, and let's focus in on this time point, the two-week time point, which here it's SA14, and the next slide is going to be SA2, but that's the two-week time point, which was surprising, just comparing this time point between the satellite cell depleted and replete mice. So did the experiment the same way, except depleting satellite cells, waiting, and then doing this interdistillation, and waiting 2 more weeks, injecting the EU 5 hours before and killing them. And what you see, whereas in the vehicle-treated mice, the percent, as I said, of positive myonuclei goes back down to baseline. You know, 15-20% of myonuclei are actually active at 14 days based on EU labeling. In the tamoxifen-treated animal, that percentage stays really high, and the intensity, if you quantify the pixel intensity of these pink nuclei, it stays high, which suggests that existing myonuclei have a huge reserve capacity. And the reason the muscle can grow without fusing in a nucleus is the existing myonuclei somehow sense that there's no help, that they sense, and normally they can sense there's another nucleus coming in, so they don't have to ramp it up. But in this case, when there are no satellite cells, the existing myonuclei, through mechanical strain or change in the cytoskeleton, something sense that, and they keep their transcriptional activity high. It was very complicated because he had to do, you know, short-lived, medium-lived, long-lived transcripts, and he mostly looked at the quantity, and I can't remember, you know, I don't think there were big difference. I mean, there wasn't much to pull down, and he just looked mostly at what pulling down at this point, and, you know, there was c-myc, there were a lot of things. I can't really remember exactly what he found, but we should, you know, look into that. I don't think it was so much that they were different, it's just that there was more of them that are hanging around comparable to the 3-day time point. So that gave us, you know, something that we want to follow up on, and this reserve capacity, because you could see if there was some way to harness that in disease or as you get older, if you've got fewer satellite cells, so fewer are fusing in, is there a way to identify how it is that these nuclei know that they have to stay active because there are no satellite cells? There may be some way to facilitate muscle hypertrophy and muscle maintenance. So the last... So just something that just wanted to touch on. Everything I've told you about is in adult mice. Just want to point out that if you do these same experiments on mice that are still growing, and this is some of Kevin's work, is that what you see is that whereas, you know, those animals with a full complement of satellite cells grow, as I've told you, those in these young 8-week-old, 2 to 3-month-old mice don't grow without satellite cells. So there's some kind of transition. So if your muscle's already actively growing, you're a growing mouse, and then you deplete satellite cells, and then you do synergistablation, the muscle says, sorry, maybe they're already in their maps, and then the muscle can't grow. And that there may be some kind of transition when the mouse stops growing to a satellite cell independent sort of ability to grow. Okay, so... So now let's get back to this idea of, okay, so that in adult animals they do grow, and I've shown you up here, you know, satellite cells are no, they grow, but the growth does become blunted, and it's the CSA, it's just shown here, and the reason, coming back to this idea that we think this is because the muscle becomes fibrotic. So over the course of 8 weeks of this overload, here by staining for collagen with Picrocereus red or with the WGA that stains glycosaminoglycans, what you can see is this with overload, even without overload, just vehicle tamoxifen, if you wait long enough, the muscles become a bit fibrotic. But when you throw in overload, they really... become very fibrotic. And we actually think that that may be what's limiting this ultimate growth. And that's a topic that we're studying. And one way to study that is by taking the satellite cells out, culturing them in vitro, and one of the primary cell types in muscle that make all the collagen in the extracellular matrix are fibroblasts. And so if you culture fibroblasts with the daughter cells of satellite cells, myogenic progenitor cells, what you can see then is that if you do that, there is something that's secreted by the myogenic progenitor cells that appears to inhibit collagen, gene expression, and other extracellular matrix components like fibronectin from the fibroblasts. And so here again, it points to another, a different role for satellite cells in muscle, and that is really controlling the extracellular environment during adaptation. Because if you're growing, you've got to remodel your extracellular matrix to make more space, and you've got to be more flexible. And that maybe satellite cells, and what we're exploring in this tale is how does satellite cells exactly do this? And what we think they do, how they do it, is by secreting exosomes. Exosomes are a big hot area of research right now, and what we're thinking is that they secrete exosomes that get delivered with cargo in them, that get delivered to fibroblasts and thereby regulate gene expression. And that's, we've tested that idea by using conditioned media. So as opposed to doing co-culture of these cell types and showing that if you co-culture fibroblasts with myogenic progenitor cells that you inhibit collagen gene expression, if you take fibroblast conditioned medium or as a control, or a myoblast or myogenic progenitor cell conditioned media, or you just isolate exosomes from the myogenic progenitor cells, you see that all can inhibit collagen gene expression in fibroblasts. And again, a mechanism that we think this might be happening is via delivery of microRNAs. Because if you label the exosomes with acridine orange, which intercalates into RNA, before you isolate them and put them on fibroblasts, you see that the fibroblasts end up with acridine orange labeled RNA. And so we're studying in detail how this happens. And how we're doing that is using this same strategy with the PAX7 Cre driver driving a Phlox dicer mouse. So now this is no DTA. We're not killing the satellite cells. All we're doing is deleting a gene. And dicer is what an enzyme which is required to make mature our microRNAs. All right. So if now you isolate MPCs and you treat them with tamoxifen in vitro, so you're going to delete the dicer gene, and over time you're going to deplete microRNAs from the MPCs and their exosomes. What you see, you're looking at a couple of different microRNAs, that those exosomes are much less effective, because you see that the extracellular matrix gene expression is higher in the fibroblasts. So looking at the mechanisms of how satellite cells might be regulating the extracellular matrix, a new role for them, independent of their fusing into a muscle fiber, you know, this regenerative role. So now I'm going to close and end on what the role of satellite cells in muscle maintenance. It makes sense that if you deplete satellite cells and the muscles can't repair themselves, that over time you're going to lose mass. And so the experiments that we did with this mouse, as opposed to doing sort of just acute experiments, and although I've shown you experiments where we went out to 8 weeks of overload, here what I want to show you are just some results which again have surprised us in terms of what satellite cells might or might not be doing in muscle. And in this case, there's no synergistic relation, there's no running, there's no nothing. These are just sedentary mice that are treated with tamoxifen at 4 months of age. Just let them sit in their cage for a month, and then you kill them. So they're 5 months old, and all the slides, those are young mice. And then some you just put aside, and no wheel, no nothing, just let them hang out for 20 more months until they're 2 years old. Okay? And the idea was, if these mice have lived for 20 months, they are essentially the majority of their adulthood without satellite cells, you would think that the muscles would waste and that you would accelerate sarcopenia, you would accelerate. This would be a, I mean, we went into this thinking this was going to be a premature aging model, a premature muscle aging model. And the reason we can do this experiment is because once you deplete the satellite cells, even though it's not 100%, they don't recover, which has been something that I also don't really understand and would like to know why. If there's bona fide stem cells and you kill most of them, you know, we kill more than 90%, 95% of them, but you got a few. And if they're stem cells, why can't they repopulate? But they don't. So it allows us to do this experiment, and that's illustrated in two ways. Functionally, because you can see this is an, now the 24-month animal, a subset of them before we killed them, we inject barium chloride and waited a week. So you see regeneration. You can see the old animal regeneration is defective. But without the ones that lived their whole lives without satellite cells, complete no regeneration, zero. And the satellite cells stay effectively depleted. So if you're in the 5-month-old animal, normal complement of satellite cells, those little PAX7 positive green specks. Old animals, they're decreased. And then the plantaris, by 50%, pretty significantly with age. The tamoxifen treatment decreases them far lower than ever occurs during aging. And they stay low. And that's shown here, just the PAX7 cells just with age, and here's with the tamoxifen treatment. You see they stay low. And to our surprise, now if you just look at the mean CSA in the young either vehicle or tamoxifen or age vehicle tamoxifen, you see sarcopenia at 24 months. The muscles are all mostly smaller. But there's no effect of not having satellite cells. And that extends to not only to mass, you know, where you see sarcopenia, but it's not, from comparing the young versus the old animal, there's no difference whether you have satellite cells there or not. And another feature of sarcopenia, which perhaps you talked about aging, is that not only do you lose muscle mass, so your fibers get smaller, give a specific force, so that's force per unit area also declines. So it's a double whammy that you get, you lose fibers, existing fibers shrink, and the amount of force for their area is less. And that happens with aging, but it doesn't make any difference if you have satellite cells there or not. But the muscles, so there's no phenotype in terms of sarcopenia, really, except that over time, having no satellite cells for 20 months does result in increased fibrosis, but apparently not enough to really just impact or cause further atrophy, or with the absence of any kind of stimulation, it's not enough to exacerbate sarcopenia. The final concept that I wanted to just present, because of this whole, it's kind of changing our way of we're thinking of what satellite cells do in muscle, is that we thought, okay, so satellite cells aren't really required for growth in adult, they seem to be required for growth in really young animals, and you can come up with a reason, and we can design experiments to test why that might be, this idea that the existing myonuclei are maxed out. And adult animals seem to be fine. The question is, once they get old, and now you superimpose synergist ablation, now can the muscles grow without satellite cells? And we did that experiment, but the problem is, and so again, as I told you with these 24-month animals who have lived their whole life without satellite cells, a subset of them, we injected barium chloride to show that regeneration was defective, and in another subset, we actually did the synergist ablation and let them go 2 weeks to quantify growth. And the experiment, I don't want to say it was a bust, but it basically, neither, the old animals didn't grow. So whether they had satellite cells there or not, there was no significance in a significant increase in cross-sectional area. Which speaks to this whole idea is that in old muscle there's this anabolic resistance, so that even if you give them a stimulus and you give them the muscles a hypertrophic growth stimulus, they just can't grow. And that seems to be the case in these old animals, even though there's satellite cell fusion. So in those animals that have satellite cells, these old animals, they did increase their myonuclear number, but that, and the and those without satellite cells did not. But as I just said, it didn't matter. They didn't grow in any case. So that this is the first indication that, at least in old animals, myonuclear accretion, so fusing in a satellite, so the stimulus is there, the muscle senses it, the satellite cells sense it, they're fusing in, but there's this anabolic resistance and the fibers can't grow, so the myonuclear domain gets way smaller. So you've got a higher density of nuclei in the fiber, but it's not increasing in volume. So, here are just some of the sort of summary of what sort of we know about these unique and different roles of satellite cells. We've gone through, you know, all of these. Some rather surprising, some not so surprising in terms of the response to physical activity, muscle hypertrophy, this idea that satellite cells regulate the extracellular matrix so that if you don't have them, your muscle will become fibrotic over time, which would be a bad thing. And we're now, you know, trying to look at the mechanisms of how satellite cells communicate with other cells, including fibroblasts. To our surprise, in the adult animal, if you deplete satellite cells, it doesn't cause sarcopenia, which was a very big surprise to us, and that this myonuclear accretion doesn't necessarily promote hypertrophy. So here are a couple of things that I want everybody to keep in mind as we start our discussion. One is that it does appear that compensatory mechanisms exist in adult mice that enable maintenance and adaptation independent of satellite cells. So now the question is, we can do this because we can kill satellite cells in mice, and that's, you know, that's how we've identified this compensatory mechanism. The question is this relevant to humans? And if you wanted to get at that, how would you do that? Or are we just, you know, I think as John says, are we just becoming the world's experts on mouse muscle? And that's the only place it's relevant for. And this is also something that I think provides, you know, a whole framework. So as you all know, there's a lot of people out there doing satellite cell therapy mostly for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, but for other kinds of muscle neurodegeneracy. So you've had degeneration. You would hope if you add satellite cells, that would help repair the muscle fibers, because with Duchenne, you do see a dramatic loss over the life of the kids of their satellite cells, so their muscles can't repair themselves anymore. So that's ongoing. Our work would suggest, you know, for sarcopenia and just cachexia muscle wasting, satellite cells may be not so useful, except they may be useful not so much for their role in terms of fusing in and providing a nucleus to a muscle fiber, but maybe in controlling fibrosis, because there are a lot of muscle pathologies and aging that when you naturally lose satellite cells, where some kind of satellite cell therapy may be useful in terms of controlling fibrosis. So, with that, with those keeping those sort of two ideas in mind, these were the questions that were at the end of the review article, which we think are some of the low-hanging fruit or some of the most important or sort of interesting questions as the field moves forward, looking at the role of satellite cells more globally in muscle, independent of regeneration or in addition to regeneration. And what I'd like to do, I don't know how you all do this, if people want to take a break or at least stand up for a minute, and then we can, you know, if people, different people want to pick one of these and just say, okay, if I were going to try to answer that question in mice, how would I do it? What might be a good, interesting thing to do? What sort of model, what kind of exercise do you think would be the most interesting? And then, is there any way to translate that to try to see if we're on the right track in terms of any kind of human relevance, translatability, and or therapeutic potential? So, Tim, why don't you turn on the lights back there?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to, you know, break into little groups, but we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 questions, and it would be fun if we could have at least a little bit of discussion on each one, or if some of you more interesting. If people would like to follow up on one or a couple of them, we can also do that. So what do you think? Do people need a potty break? Because I know when I came in, the women's room was closed. So I, you know, but I, she said it was closed, but I, you know, sort of barreled my way in anyway.
Uh-huh. So I think it's interesting, and there's just pretty convincing evidence that if you sleep satellite cells, it doesn't affect muscle maintenance or ability to grow muscle. But does that just like intrinsically mean that stem cells as a therapy are less effective for muscle growth? And then when you do look at this field where they are doing stem cell transplantation or engraftment, most of them are geared toward more like neurodegenerative or So, but there have been, and I'm really just thinking of one trial that Grant Olin conducted in 2011, where they did show stem cell engraftment did, you know, kind of preserve muscle and force for, you know, And so is it in private evidence that in this as well? Just like because you deplete something, does that mean adding more can have no therapy either?
It's a very good question. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? I mean, what do you think? I mean, I certainly have opinions on it, and how relevant that is. And I do think, but it's always within the context of injury. So with the work that you're talking about, is that are you talking about the one where he takes the muscle fiber with satellite cells on it and transplants that into muscle that's been barium chloride injected? And so there you see adding more caused the recovery from the barium chloride. The fibers were way bigger than they were without having these additional satellite cells. So you're right. That's sort of not perturbing what's there, just adding more. In that case, if you superimpose injury, the issue is, you know, it's not very practical. If you think about it, you got to really injure a human muscle in order to see, or maybe it is okay, you know, no pain, no gain.
I don't know what barium chloride would
do. Oh, gosh, you couldn't do that. But you could injure a muscle. Like, what if you... What those experiments are telling us that you need to go, sort of like there was a paper that just came out by Abigail Mackey and Michael Kyer.
I presented that one.
Oh, you did? Okay, so do you remember this one where, this was in Denmark, where they took humans and did they do backward cycling or downhill running? Oh, electrical stim they did. I mean, did you see the, I don't know if you showed any of the pictures. I mean, these people's muscles were, they were horribly damaged. And so, you know, maybe if you had a serious neuromuscular disease or a massive muscle loss or something, and you then had to go in and do some e-stim or, you know, backward cycling or downhill running where, you know, your quads hurt like crazy, and then if you injected them, then suddenly...
Right, and I think, something that, while that would be not, like, could be uncomfortable, usually, like, when we're thinking stem cell therapy, it's one and done. You know, one injection, and that could last you. It's not like some other therapies where it's just consistent monthly or yearly injection. And it's interesting that, you know, the phase two trials in gerontology, those weren't muscle stem cells, but they did show improvement over 6 months in like the 6 minute walk test, and indeed, you know, with a different stem cell population being injected in humans. I wish they would have had some sort of muscle data, you know, like DEXA scan, and maybe they are, I'm sure, kind of planning a phase three trial.
Yep.
So that would be interesting to see, are there any muscle-specific adaptations?
Yeah. It really would. It would. Yeah. So the thing, so what, it, again, you know, depletion may be telling you something, but it's sort of like the old, what they used to say about Drosophila genetics, where it's analogous, you know, because there for years you could delete genes and you could genetically manipulate. And so I remember way back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, the professor saying, well, yeah, but, you know, if you've got a radio and you take out a tube in it and it starts to screech, the function of that tube isn't to keep the radio from screeching. You see, I mean, you're removing... you know, so we may have this all wrong. I mean, that's the thing. But, and especially with the depleting, and then there's no loss of muscle over the life. So we've shown, I think, that nothing can substitute for satellite cells in regeneration. If you don't have them, there's not another stem cell. And with growth in the adult, since there's no myonuclear accretion. But in turnover, like maintenance, and again, you know, this idea that that's maybe a different process entirely than hypertrophy and regeneration. And there is some stem cell population that in the absence of satellite cells comes in and just replaces nuclei through the life of the animal. And we don't see any change in number, but they are there and they're doing it. And we just aren't clever enough and don't have the tools to detect and to study this population of cells that is slowly just maintaining muscle, and they're there. And I would, you know, some of the reporter mice that we're trying to develop where you could try to see that would be really cool, because I do think it's, and those, like you said, the phase two trials, maybe there are other stem cells that are doing something. We just haven't, the models we're using don't allow us to study them.
So Johnny Hewer had this great idea that he had isolated these multi-pluripotent stem cells from muscle that were not satellite cells, that he was going to revolutionize the world of muscle regeneration and recovery, and nothing happened since then.
Yeah.
And people haven't been able to reproduce as a result since then.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a funny thing, it's mostly, so how he got those cells, and again, whether this has any relevance to humans, is that he would grind up a mouse muscle. And one of the ways in the early days to isolate satellite cells is that satellite cells don't stick to plastic very well. And so this pre-plate thing came developed, because when you grind up a muscle, or you know, collagenase, dispase, digest a muscle, and you release all the mononucleated cells, where they're not satellite cells, you can see, are pretty darn rare. There's a lot more fibroblasts, there's a lot more endothelial cells, there's a lot more macrophages, there's a lot more everything that when you dispase collagenase and try to get rid of the big fibers, now you've got mononucleated cells. And one of the techniques that people have used for years is that you put that on a plate, just a plastic tissue culture dish, and you let it go for 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and you gently take off everything that doesn't stick, and you put it on another plate. And if you look on the plate, there's a bunch of cells that have already sat down and attached, and those are fibroblasts. They stick really well to plastic, whereas the satellite cells don't. So you take them off, and so what we often do when we isolate satellite cells is you do a pre-plate. And you just, because it cleans it up before you, then you go and try to really purify the satellite cells. But that pre-plate gets rid of a ton of stuff. So what Johnny did is he did that for 6 weeks. So he took the cells and he did a couple of pre-plates. I think he did like a 45-minute pre-plate. Take what didn't stick, put it on another plate. Let it go for another 45 minutes. Take that off, put it on another plate. And then he waited something like 4 or 6 weeks and took what didn't stick after 4 or 6 weeks and expanded that. And those are his, what he calls these muscle-derived stem cells. Well, what the heck those are? I mean, who knows? And that he subjected those and say that they, basically reverse aging and do all this kind of thing. And I tried back to do that, and a lot of labs did. Okay, well, I'll get those cells. Well, I could never get those cells. And mice, you know, are kind of, again, weird critters, and they're very adaptable, and you know, their cells have really long telomeres, and you can keep them in culture a really long time, whereas human satellite cells, mammals, you know, have short telomeres, and every time they divide, they shorten, and then you can't, you know, then they're senescent. In vitro, mouse cells you can keep longer, and so what he got, nobody else has been able to get that stem cell population. And he even sent us some, because I said, I want to do different things than you want to do. And basically, they were myoblasts. They were PAX7 positive myoblasts, and I could never get them to do anything special. So, It made a big splash, because he even injected an IP and showed that brain was better and muscle and everything. You know, you were young again. This fountain of youth thing, which plagues the aging field of research, because everybody, of course, wants a fountain of youth, but when people follow up on it a little bit, doesn't turn out to be, you know, here, drink this, you know, kind of thing. And you see it in the magazines and late night ads at 3 a.m, you know. Here it is. And that was sort of, but I mean, and certainly I don't think you can find, or nobody has been able to find those cells in humans.
I was, you know, when people were going around with satellite cell depletion, a couple of models have shown just
there are a couple of models where people sort of tried to do that, and one is the Syndican 4 overexpressing mouse, and Syndican is a receptor for something, FGF, or binds with the FGF receptor or something. Anyway, it's on the cell surface of myoblasts. But if you overexpress it, you get more satellite cells, and in regeneration, you get more fusion, and supposedly you get bigger myotubes and stuff, or myofibers that are bigger and have more nuclei. But there are some initial reports on that, but I haven't seen anybody follow up on that. So it's a good idea to try to see if there's some way you could push it and add more. I mean, is that your point, to try to push it, add more, and see if it does good?
But in my master's, there's a piece of things doing mesh, kind of knock down.
Yeah.
So the cells, there's way much easier than doing it in vivo right now. And the time you know, if you know, already max, they express something that you can do mesh, so they don't have to do some of these. But I don't feel a lot of people have done that, you know, for example, just to see the response.
Yeah.
Because I know you're probably, the other thing is you're going to have an elevated CSA or muscle blood base just off the start of seeing
your
Correct me if I'm wrong. So I think that you win beta catenin knockout in muscle, and you overload results in far more satellite cells from the overload. So at baseline, it's the same, but then the overload, we saw way more satellites, at least after 7 days. But to my knowledge, that did not result in a larger fibrosis. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's sort of kind of
getting at that. And and that hasn't been followed up sufficiently, because it might be you could push it in that model that it's, you know, beta-catenin interfering with notch and all kinds of downstream signaling. It might be a good model to study that. So I think there are genetic mouse models that would be amenable, but people, like you say, just aren't really looking at it within the context of exercise or normal stimuli. It's always, you know, inject barium chloride, tear up the muscle, and then look at regeneration, which, you know, is worth studying. It's just that it's not very physiological.
Is there a way to John can make anything. I didn't discover John can make anything. Is there a way to conditionally do that, though, so that when you get to an aged mouse and conditionally that somehow rescue fibrosis through all of a sudden increase satellite cells without having to have a perturbation of any kind of exercise?
Yeah. I think that's theoretically possible. The problem is that none of these pathways do just one thing. So, like, if you were to block notch, but, you know, the thing about this, if you can do it at a specific time in the life of the animals and in a specific cell type, you know, then you're on to something. But it's just that, yeah. So that I think there are ways, and because of these tools that are available, that you can do it. At a specific time, you avoid all the developmental defects and growth defects. You do it in an adult animal and see and target it to, you know, a specific cell type, so that, you know, with the Prelog's technology or TED on, TED off, you know, just pick a, find a promoter that's specific to your cell type of interest. And then you use that to drive Cree or to drive TED-O, I mean, to drive the RTTA, whatever you want to do. And so you manipulate that gene just in your cell type of interest, whether that's in the muscle fiber only or the satellite cell only or the macrophage only or the endothelial cell only, you theoretically could do that.
So that seems like what you're talking about, what we were mentioning. If you could hit this fibroblast specifically, and I don't know if the fibroblasts in muscle are different markers than other fibroblasts, if you could reduce those, maybe
that's
like
a
Cas9, like we were talking about, being really specific.
The problem is fibroblast markers. You know, what is a fibroblast? There's actually a lot of arguments about what, you know, that supposedly, because you've got FAPs, you know, fibroblastic adipogenic progenitors, and then they differentiate, but what is a differentiated fibroblast? And then people even talk about myofibroblasts, which aren't muscle-specific. Myofibroblast is supposed to be one that's fully differentiated and really cranking out collagen and is vimentin positive and all this kind of thing. But to find a promoter that's restricted to fibroblasts is not...
Not feasible yet.
I'm not... Like, maybe TCF4, there are a couple of candidates. The problem is there, if you did it, you know, in fibroblasts and you wanted to target muscle fibroblasts, but then you'd also target lung fibroblasts and where you need them, and they're a good thing, and then suddenly the next thing you know,
your lungs
are falling apart because there's no fibroblasts making ECM. So that's a non-tissue specific cell type is more tricky. So controlling fibroblasts is...
So I think we talked about it earlier, too, about, like, why not just elderly people take, testosterone or something and increase muscle mass to keep it from wasting? Would that work?
So. Well, there are lots of testosterone trials out there, and it hasn't really been very effective. I mean...
Yeah, testosterone is a little bit
of a... You have to speak up. I can't hear you.
Oh, I mean, they're not doing any kind of training.
Side effects.
Yeah.
You know, same kind of thing with growth hormone therapy, which, you know, the balance, the pros and cons.
Because testosterone seems like the biggest benefit. It is not just like growth inside of it. It improves recovery. So, say with training, if you train, take testosterone, you're able to train harder the next time. And harder training, you know, is one of the good things to do.
But I do think that the reason athletes take it, you know, dopers, it does help with that, so that there could be some, if you were clever enough with the right dose and the right exercise regimen in older people, maybe you could come up with something that wasn't, didn't have bad side effects and didn't, you know, put them at risk for other problems.
Or is it muscle?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, do things when they're young and hope that the muscle remembers and doesn't crap out when it's old.
Because like you said, the testosterone facilitates cell and cell proliferation and not proliferation, especially in the context of like, well, actually, just the new by itself should do that.
Especially if once you have myonuclei. So if you train and you fused in nuclei, or you've got normal muscle, you know, and you atrophy, but you keep the same number of nuclei, so then you regrow. And if you train and you've got big muscles with lots of nuclei, if you quit training, do those nuclei hang around? I mean, that's a question. So that's the basis of the training effect. Or no, it doesn't have anything to do with that, and that it's something else. Or, you know, it's, nobody knows, but it could have something to do with myonuclear accretion, and that once you do that, you're at an advantage, and those hang around forever, your nuclei. Or you have a constant myonuclear number. Could be interesting.
So related to that one topic there about mechanical-induced hypertrophy, do you think that just the stretching of the muscle, or do you think actually at the neuromuscular junction there might be local regulation that would say that's higher activity, and maybe even growth factors that come from the nerve terminal? And the other kind of question comes about, do you have equal distribution of satellite cells along the muscle? You know, in the length?
No, you don't.
So
they're localized at the neuromuscular junction.
Yes, so maybe that's a key element for actually understanding how to get those incorporated in the cell.
Yeah.
Really from activity-dependent transmitter, receptor-mediated, acetylcholine receptor turn-on, because those nuclei are a little bit different,
they are,
even under that neuromuscular junction than others. So maybe those factors are what's keeping the satellite cells present.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It gets at that communication, too, with other cell types, that satellite cells aren't evenly distributed in muscle. They're localized at the neuromuscular junction, so they are probably communicating with the neuron. They seem to be localized near endothelial cells, so near capillaries. And there's some work, on mostly in vitro, showing an endothelial cell-satellite cell interaction, so that might be good. And the idea that macrophages, too, produce things that help satellite cells. So there may be macrophage-satellite cell direct interaction to produce growth factors and things. But then so tell me about that, because that's an interesting idea. Because this idea that if you've got a fiber, and it's contracting, I mean, you know, you're working, you're doing whatever, so it's being stimulated from the motor neuron, and there's satellite cells there. And then so what you're saying is that it's not that the satellite, that the existing myonuclei send some perturbation to the cytoskeleton when the nucleus fuses in, and they say, oh, thank God, you've got help. It's that when they're gone, the motor neuron is sending totally different signals to the fiber that...
Well, you wonder about acetylcholine isn't the only thing that's released from the nerve terminal. I mean, ATP is released in addition, and they know that Schwann cells, you know, next to the junction actually pick up on the ATP, purinergic receptors. So you wonder about other cells around the neuromuscular junction that might be giving communication to that local region, and it could be exons again, right?
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
Or some secreted factor that says, hey, you know, and maybe even the retrograde feedback saying, I'm not getting enough communication, you know, grow more, put out more. We need more synapses, we need more transmission.
That's
a localized feedback to those nuclei to be more productive, or maybe sending out another signal to the satellite cell there, say, hey, we're not getting as much transmission, and maybe it's really the communication at that point.
Yeah, I like that idea.
And I'm on the same lines about it, really tiny, of course, amounts, but has anybody ever looked into your laryngeal muscles in those accent BTA mice? And I ask that because they're multi-innervated. They are said to have consistent, always activated satellite cell populations and undergo regeneration consistently, which is now the going hypothesis is why they're resistant to muscle dystrophy.
Yeah.
So they're always a little bit smaller, but they're always regenerating constantly. And but they have the multiple innervation thing is there's always been interest to me about those. They have these populations of nuclei every so the thing is things that fibers about 4 millimeters long in the human, the TA muscle is 2 centimeters long. So tiny fibers, multiple innervated, and they're all constantly active.
Huh.
And so but they're also spared. And the idea too is that because they're innervated by cranial nerves, cranial nerves communicate differently with these muscles that makes them do this. Because only one muscle of the group of frontal muscles that's the most skeletal muscle left is the cricothyroid, and it's innervated by a different nerve and behaves like a skeletal muscle. So
really?
So it sucks in comparison to all its friends. Right?
Yeah. So, well, you know, we have looked because it's the same kind of way with the extraocular muscle, the supervess, where it too is small and it's got a high volume of satellite cells and it's constantly regenerating and it's spared in muscular dystrophy. So yeah.
And multiply innervated.
Innervated. And so we have looked at those muscles in the PAX7DTA mouse with Linda Van Loon, and hopefully that will get written up and stuff. And she's identified potentially a specific stem cell population, because again, depleting satellite cells doesn't seem to interfere with the extraocular muscle function. You know, it's all this negative data that drives me crazy. But they are just like in the diaphragm. There may be there you can identify, because that muscle is different, that this PIDX2, there's this population of stem cells that express this transcription factor called PIDX2, which is specific to the extraocular, or it's at least not skeletal muscle that we can detect. And that population may take up, when you deplete satellite cells, it takes over, and it can maybe even be converted to satellite cells, or anyway, so that it's a different can of worms. And I suspect the laryngeal muscle, and we have PAX7 DTAs coming down the pipe, we should dissect out some laryngeal muscles and see, because, you know, we've done, like I said, the extraocular muscle, but and I was sure it would be I wasn't. My hypothesis was, but they're unlike in skeletal muscle, where we have yet to identify a stem cell population that's substituting in the extraocular and potentially the laryngeal muscle. It's a completely different system, and there are different stem cells and different communication from the neuron. I should say that there is one group that is doing it, but again, it's all a regeneration model. It's not really looking at normal innervation in the PAX7 DTA mice, Chakalala. And what he's done is he cuts the sciatic nerve, and so you get retraction of the motor neuron in the PAX7 DTA mice. And what he sees is that the regrowth and the reinnervation is effective, and it's really slowed or doesn't even happen when you don't have satellite cells. So there he's more looking at guidance and
stuff like that.
And stuff. So clearly there's interaction, though.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
He might not be able to have to cut the nerve, but actually silence it with cuffs, and you could actually do a cold cuff and keep the activity, electrical activity down, or, you know, things like that, or even the Botox kind of thing.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
Lots
and
of
that's,
interesting
that
stuff.
Would be an interesting thing to do, because he doesn't see, I have to say that just in his control animals, he doesn't see a phenotype when there's no satellite cells. But he doesn't do exercise. I mean, just it's a sham, just an animal there. It's not, the muscles aren't wasted. There's nothing going on. But, you know, when you then denervate, you see a phenotype in the PAX7 DTA mouse.
He also uses young mice.
Very, very young mice, yeah.
Well, we got about a minute left before the next class is going to start invading us. But maybe we could, you know, maybe think about what you think. Maybe some people want to take on some of these topics as a research paper or more aspects, or talk about it later on, you know?
Yeah. You sent us
these are in the paper. So in that review paper, these are at the end, the low-hanging, or just the things that we thought were most interesting and that most, and somewhat challenging.
Yes.
But, yeah, I'd love for anybody to share any ideas on it. That would be great. Okay, well, thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.